Good morning, everyone. My name is Jim. I am an alcoholic. And I'm very, very honored to be here, to be a part of this wonderful convention. It has been a wonderful convention, hasn't it? Oh, my God. It really has. As with most of my experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love the speakers. The speakers have been amazing. But it's the little stuff that happens between the meetings, the one-on-ones with people that is just really, that's where the action is. Y'all taught me that years ago. My sponsor, Jimmy Dean, he said, you reach out to the new person. You talk to the new person. I really loved what Earl shared last night about the new people, and I hope that they're in the room this morning. But here's the thing that I thought about this morning as I was thinking about doing this. I thought about the first time I ever got up in front of the podium like this. And I got to tell you, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in Athens, my sobriety date, July 12th, 1979, I got sober in, I'm grateful for that. I really am. I came to in Athens, Georgia. I had no idea that that's where it was going to happen. A lot of people say, you got sober in Athens? Nobody can get sober in Athens. That's where I got sober. And part of the reason I was able to get sober in Athens was, well, it was a couple of things. One, I was ready and I didn't even know how ready I was. I'd been hitchhiking. And let me just kind of tell you how I ended up in Athens on July the 11th, 1979. I came to in a ditch on highway, I think it's Highway 84 between Thomasville and Valdosta. Any of y'all know that stretch of road? Is it 84? Well, the thing about South Georgia that is really nice if you live on the street, on the road, the ditches, they're so different than up here. I mean, they're nice, grassy, slopey, you know. So when I had a parting of the ways, it was a real religious moment that night. My dad had sent me on a mission with his car at 10 o'clock in the morning, and I was supposed to be back by about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I come dragging in at 1 a.m. with my little brother. This was on July the 10th. I was supposed to leave from Boston, Georgia. Any of y'all know where Boston is? Yeah? Nelson does. And by the way, I really want to thank this man in the yellow shirt here for being so gracious with me this weekend. You've really double-timed it, including, and I know I'm bouncing around, but that's what the higher power told me to do, because I asked him, what am I supposed to say? He said, just tell the truth. So I called Nelson as I was driving up on Friday morning, and this is something that I have learned. Anybody from Atlanta here? Don't you love the closeness of everybody up there, especially on the freeways? Well, I don't know what it is about that my wife Winnie is in the room. Winnie, can you stand up? I just want them to see my beautiful, beautiful wife. Again, a blessing of sobriety. Blessing of sobriety. But the reason I looked at her is she knows about me and my driving. I can get up here and talk all good spiritual stuff, and she will say, yeah, well, have you ever been with him when he's driving? And maybe some of y'all can relate to this. I get on the road. Okay, I need to be such and such a place. It's only 3 miles down the road. I should be able to get there in 20 minutes. So that's my goal and my plan, and I've got to be there. And so I start, and as soon as I get out there, 7 self-indulging assholes just cut right in front. It's like, what? What do I look like? I mean, you know what? And so then I start reacting. Says, you're going to do me? What is that famous Robert De Niro line? Me? you know, that's, and so I start reacting, and I start doing the same stuff they're doing. I get infected with this thing, and it's not good. It's not good. This is really, and I hate it when people in the program, like my sponsor Ben, sitting next to my brother Arch. I'm going to point Archie out too. Archie has been an active member of Al-Anon now for what, 15 years? 16, excuse me. And today is his birthday. Happy birthday, Arch. Yes, yes. So he left his family to come to be with us, to be with me. And Archie carried me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll be forever grateful for that. But driving, getting back to Nelson, this is one of the things that I've learned about driving in bad traffic. What works for me, I discovered this. Get on the phone. I've got a car with its speaker, you know, and just talk to a member of Alcoholics Anonymous while you're driving. I stop. I'm watching where I'm going, but I'm not focusing on, I cannot believe you did that to me, you asshole. And I'm not doing that. I'm talking to someone. So people, and I just slow down, and I let them go, and it's like, oh. Well, he spent an hour on the phone with me just to get me out of Atlanta. I said, I need you to stay. I said, I don't know what we're going to talk about, but I just need you to help me get through. And so we ended up on 675, and it was good to go. Thank you. And so I really do appreciate Nelson. He's been there for me in many, many ways. But on July the 11th, I woke up in a ditch because when I showed up at 1 a.m., my father, you know how we are. We can be drunk, but we're not stupid. I mean, we have this intuition when somebody is kind of done with us, you know. My father was old school. He was a World War II soldier, that kind of thing. And he wore those old, what we now call wife beater shirts. That's what he wore. Well, at 1 a.m., I pull up in the yard. I had gone to Tifton to pick up my brother David and bring him back home. We're supposed to be back home at 1 p.m., and we showed up at 1 a.m. Why? Well, I hadn't seen him in so long. We needed to go out and celebrate, so it had been 2 weeks. So I took him to a local pool hall in Tifton, and we closed it down and pulled up. And when we pulled up in the yard, the storm door of the house was closed. The inside door was open, but the storm door was closed. And the room was dark, but I could see the silhouette of that white wife beater shirt standing inside the house. I could see it. Now, I'm drunk, but I know what it means, you know. I could feel it, you know. And so I sent David in the house. I said, go say hi to Dad, you know. Maybe soften him up a little bit. And I had one more beer to finish and build up my courage and strength. And so David goes in, moves on. The wife beater t-shirt is standing there waiting. And I said, okay. So by the time I get up on the front porch, he meets me outside. And that's when it began. And we had fought before, but this one, he really started hitting below the belt. And he was a guy that totally did not understand me, you know. He tried to control my life, you know. I hated this thing. He used to always say, if you're going to stay under my roof, it's going to be blah, blah. Any of y'all ever have to put up with that crap? I mean, come on, I'm a 26-year-old man, you know. So we had a parting of the ways. It was a real prodigal son kind of a moment, you know. And basically, if we're going to split this 50-50, I take the inside of the house, you take the outside, and don't come back. So I got my sleeping bag, my old pair of blue jeans, kissed my dog goodbye, grabbed my guitar, and hit the road. Sounds like a country song, right? Country western. Yeah, it's a true story. So this is Boston, Georgia. For those of y'all that know Boston, Georgia, they've, to this day, they've got one traffic light right in the center of town that's been turned off now probably for 45 years. The light has. So I'm walking out of town with my stuff, and they had one cop in Boston, and I was the only activity at 1:15 in the morning, so Barney comes pulling up and says, "Who are you? What are you doing?" And so I told him who I was. I was my daddy's son, and I'm leaving town. And he said, "Oh, okay." He looked at me. He had to know I was drunk, and he said, "Well, get in the car. I'll take you there." And he did. He literally drove me about 3 miles to the city limit sign, which was the end of his jurisdiction, dropped me out, and said, "Bye-bye." Now, any of you all that have been in this kind of a situation, you know, I'm drunk, and I just had a fight with my old man, and I hit below the belt. He said some pretty nasty things to me. He started calling me alcoholic. I said, "Okay, you want to do that?" So I started taking his inventory a little bit, and he had stood up and said, I could tell I hurt him. I hurt him, you know, and he said, "That's the way you feel about it. I'll give you $100 in the morning. You get the hell out of here. Don't come back." Now, I'm drunk enough, and it felt right. I said, "If that's the way you feel about it, you know where you can stick your $100, because I ain't going to be here in the morning." Boy, it felt good saying it. Didn't feel so good living it. But when Barney dropped me off, and I looked at that ditch, I said, "We're good. We're good." It was nice, grassy, slopey ditch. I didn't have to worry about falling out. You know, you just roll out your sleeping bag. What is it in the vision for you? It says something about the four horsemen. What's the first one? Terror? Okay, well, I came to at 6:01, I think, with total abject terror. Why? Because there was an 18-wheeler that just barreled right past my head about 3 feet from just, wow, and I just, holy shit, came to. And I became aware of two things. It was raining. And in fact, it had been raining for a while. The other thing I became aware of, and I don't know if anybody else has had this ditch kind of experience, but there was a dog on the other side of this cow pasture fence, another 10 feet from me, that was standing there, whoa, 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 just going. And he had been doing it all night long. You know, it just sort of came out of my conscience. I'd been listening to this all night. So anyway, I get up, and in typical... The thing that's amazing to me about my act of alcoholism, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, even when Archie brought me, I heard someone mention, I don't think I'd ever really heard this word before, but I liked it. First expression in Alcoholics Anonymous that I latched onto, social drinking. I heard somebody say, "Social drinking." And I said, "Shit, I think that's me." I remembered all three occasions when I had drank socially, you know. Never stopped to look at the context, you know. One of them, you know, I was drinking, only had two drinks. She's on the other side of the room watching. Two drinks, we're good, you know. It's sort of like diarrhea. You know, at some point you've got to finish it, you know. But it's amazing to me that I grabbed a hold of that because... this was normal for me. And I want to go back to something that Dr. Silkworth said, and I love what some of the speakers have alluded to that particular expression, that my alcoholic world became the only normal one. I mean, what kind of thinking is it that you get up, roll up your wet sleeping bag, grab your guitar, and you start thinking about, okay, what's my life strategy now? You know, young people in high school these days, they sit down with a career counselor or academic, you know, and they say, "Well, where do you want to go? Where do you want to be in 5 years?" Well, it was like, "What am I going to do now?" And that was normal for me. I'd only ended up at my parents' because that was the only place it would take me at that point in my life. I had no place to go, anything to do. So my new life plan, it came to me. Inspiration. Several months before, I'd seen my buddy Jay from Roswell. I don't know if Jay's in the room here. He had long red hair down to his ass. He played guitar. We played guitar together. He was a good buddy. And when I graduated from college, he said, "Hey, if you're ever up in Roswell, look me up. We'll hang out." That's where I'm going. I have no idea where he is. I'm going to find Jay and hang out. So I'm going to Roswell, Georgia. I knew sort of where it was. And so anyway, I grab my stuff. Here comes another 18-wheeler on that road. I stick out my thumb. He stopped. Now, this, to me, this is where, and Jim T. said, "Don't forget, Sunday morning, you're supposed to talk, it's supposed to be a spiritual talk." Yeah, and I'm sitting there thinking all kinds of things. Oh, okay, what I should say. Hell, the whole damn thing's spiritual, or it's nothing. You know, that's what came to me right before I started. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 traditions, all of it, the fellowship, that one-on-one connection that I make with you all. If it ain't spiritual, I don't know what else to call it. But spiritual things were happening in this boy's life at that particular moment, and I didn't even know it. The fact that the first vehicle, after I gathered my stuff up, stopped and carried me to Valdosta was one of those. Why? Because my mother was right behind that, driving around looking for me to straighten out all of the mess. Thank God she didn't find me. I may not be here today. And I've told her this. Why would my mother do that? Because she loves me. Is she codependent or whatever you want to call it? Yes. But I'm her son. She didn't want her son sleeping passed out in a ditch on the side of a road. So, see, these are the kind of things I had to start looking at after I got sober. The pain that I put people through. That I didn't. My reaction at that point, my only normal life was, "I'm not bothering you. Leave me the hell alone. I'm doing what I want to do. You go do what you want to do." Never stopping to look, not only of the importance, but the unavoidable connection that I have with people. I'm built that way. He dropped me off at the entrance ramp onto I-75. I'm walking down. You're not supposed to hitchhike on the interstate, but I was going to right down at the bottom of the hill. Before I could get down to the bottom of the ramp, there's an old, I don't know, 1967 Biscayne Bel Air, some big land yacht that was throwing smoke out. African-American couple, they were newlyweds. They were in their 60s. This is in July. They had gotten married in March in Jacksonville, and we're still on their honeymoon. And when the sun came up that morning, he said, "Hey, Martha, look, we're in Georgia." And he said, "You know, I hadn't seen my mother in Macon in 10 years. Let's go on up to Macon." So he's going down the ramp. He sees me, has his wife throw open the door, and he says, "Hey, you going this way? Get in." So I got in. Driving down the road, and he pulls out a couple of quarts of whatever, starts passing it between me and her, and I'm in between them. She's on this side, and you know, and I'm in the middle, and we're talking, and he's explaining to me about how she cannot hold her liquor. She's got a problem. And I'm looking at her, and I'm looking at him, and it was beginning to happen. Things were beginning to happen. He literally dropped me off in South Macon over there, Rocky Creek. I stood there. I'd never been to Macon before that I can remember. I stood there on that interstate ramp, I don't know how long, trying to catch a ride. Again, no idea where I was going. Was it raining? Yes, it was still raining. Not heavy, but it was raining. Look it up. It rained in over the entire state of Georgia all day on July the 11th, 1979. I guarantee it. I know because I was in it. Long and short of it, I ended up on 285, and I had my thumb out again. And this, by this time, it's like 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and the traffic even then was already just wall to wall. I mean, it was like six lanes of cars just going, and you know, they're spraying up water and stuff. And I'm sitting there thinking, this ain't going to happen. I'm not going to get a ride. And all of a sudden, there was an old beat up red pickup truck way over in the far left lane. He started. Almost had three accidents. He's honking and just weaving, just and got off on the road. I said, "Hell, there's my ride!" And I went running up, threw my guitar, my sleeping bag in the back, got in with this guy. And anybody that's ever done the hitchhiking thing, you know the deal. You know, it's that first 4 seconds. You know, okay, do I bust out the window, dive out? I mean, is this Jeffrey Dahmer? You know, you don't know. But it was the only way I had to get around. I didn't have a driver's license. I didn't have a car. And so he started, he said, "I see you have a guitar." I said, "What kind of music you play?" So I told him, and he said, "Well, I play guitar too." I said, "Well, what kind of music do you play?" He said, "Country, Western, and gospel, mostly gospel." And I went, "Oh, good, he's not going to rape me." You know, so we're driving down 285, and I'm thinking, okay, I've got to get around to the north side to get over to Roswell. Silence. "Do you mind if I ask you a personal question?" I said, "Here it comes." I said, "No, go ahead." And he says, "Have you ever heard of the Lord Jesus Christ?" Now, this is the irony of this. In June of that same year, June of 1979, I graduated from Berry College with an undergraduate degree in philosophy and religion. I studied that stuff. Why? Because it was easy. That was the only reason. Why did I go back to college? My drunk, alcoholic brother, B, was my career counselor at the time we were drunk. He said, "What the hell are you going to do with your life? Get back to school." And he talked me into it because of the GI Bill. And I said, work 40 hours a week, get the GI Bill, go to school 2 hours a day, stay drunk. That sounds good to me. So they pulled the rug out from under me. They gave me a college degree. They said, "God bless you. You're a college graduate. Go." That's when my world really fell apart. I had been in active alcoholism, but that's when it really fell apart. That's when I had moved back home with my folks. But when he asked that question, all I could say was, "Yeah, I've heard of him somewhere." Now, you have to know that when I was in this college program, I was in a program that was filled with young, aspiring ministers. Berry College is, or was at that time, a religious college, and there was a lot of young, soon-to-be Baptist ministers. And then there was me. Long, greasy hair, always smelling hungover. I would come into class 5 minutes late. The only time I ever saw my biblical archaeology professor smile was when I came dragging in late and I had a little dog that I'd picked up at the bar the night before coming into the class with me. He usually scowled at me, and I walked in, and that little critter was behind me. He sensed it too. It was like everybody's turning and looking at this. Like, "Why are you here? You know, why are you in this?" You know, and I go up and I sit in my chair, and the little dog is slinking along, and he gets curls up underneath my chair and sits there and looking out. We're both looking the same way. My professor fell out. It's the only time he just started laughing. You know, and so I was, "Shit, okay, we're good." This guy dropped me off at Stone Mountain Freeway. That was where he was getting off. And this was another one of those God moments for me, because I was going to walk across 78, get back on 285 and keep going north. But I stopped. I drove by there the other day and is so different. But back in 1979, if any of y'all remember, there was this humongous, I mean, there was an old rotten tobacco barn right there on that corner that was as big as this complex. It was huge. And I'm standing there, he drives off, and I looked across, I saw that, and I went, I've seen that before, been here. And then I realized, from Berry College, I used to hitchhike to Athens to visit my brothers, and all of a sudden I thought, just new life plans. Maybe I'm supposed to go to Athens. So I stuck out my thumb, got a ride to Snellville, got back out on the road, and a guy in an old rusty Karmann Ghia pulled up, and he said, I can't believe it's you. Get in the car. And I've never seen this guy before in my life. But I got in the car. This was his story. He's driving down 78. He sees me on the side of the road. And he says, I ought to give that guy a ride. He looks interesting. He said, nah, to hell with him. And kept going. But then in Snellville, he got off to get a McDonald's fish sandwich. I remember. And he got back on the road, and there I was. And that was his reaction. He said, damn, I can't believe it. So I got in the car with this guy. He was on his way to Monroe, which is not Athens. But the guy ended up taking me all the way to Athens, to my brother's house, on one condition. And this is how things went back in those days. He said, if you play me a song on your guitar when we get there, I'll take you on to your brother's house. So he did, and I did. It was, the song was an old Bob Dylan tune that Jimi Hendrix made famous. All along the watchtower, must be some way out of here, cried the Joker to the thief. Too much confusion, I can't get no relief. Now this was the thing that happened. I did not know that I was at a point in my life, and I'm not telling my whole drinking story. I mean, for me, the very first time I drank was a spiritual experience. I don't know if any of y'all can relate to that. It wasn't like, oh, this is nice, I feel relaxed and more sociable. No, it was like, I got it. I'm connected, finally. I get the universe, everything's good, you know, and I kept looking for that over and over again. But at this particular point in my life, it was over. It had stopped working. And I didn't even know that it had stopped working. Chet, is that you back there? Chet, Sandy needs to see you after the meeting. Okay? Yeah, okay. Sorry, I just had to do that. Yeah, you're welcome. But I played the song. And this was a thing that was very shocking. I didn't know this guy. He pulled this ring off his finger and set it on my knee. And my first thought was, oh shit. What's this guy want? But then my eyes met his eyes and there was something different. I don't know. It was like, I don't know why. I've had that same look in my eye with many, many alcoholics since then. But the look that was in his eye was one of genuine love. He said, it's yours. I want you to have it. And good luck with your life. And that was it. He was my angel. I haven't had a drink or drug since. Now, yeah. I didn't know that that's what was going to happen. I didn't know. There was two people inside this old hippie house, and Archie knows the place very well. It was Grand Central Station. It was right next to the college campus, and people were always coming and going. I think they were growing weed in the backyard. You know, it was the garden home. You know, that was the... A lot of interesting characters, and it wasn't just all drunks and addicts. They had religious people. Eddie DeCristofaro, I can break his anonymity because he's not one of us. Eddie was a little humble guy who didn't drink. He loved to hang out there. I don't know, maybe he needed Al-Anon. I don't know. But Eddie at that particular point in 1979 was really taken with Mother Teresa. And made a decision to join the Brothers of Charity. And he did, yes? Yeah. And then there was another guy sitting there in the living room. I'm sitting on this old couch, and I'm just withdrawing from alcohol, and I'm looking at this ring. Jim D was, any of y'all remember Cat Stevens? Long jet black hair with a beard and, you know, swashbuckling kind of look. Well, that was Jim Dunning. He was, and Jim was a drunk. I mean, he was a bagpipe player, literally. That's what he did. He played bagpipe and was one of us. I mean, he was just a very flamboyant character. Anyway, he's the one that took the ring. He said, it's a seal ring. It's backwards. And he held it up to the mirror and he says, Omnia vincit amor. That's what it says on it. Latin, love conquers all. I believe in that. That is what has kept me in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's what began the life transformation that happened for me. And it's what continues to keep me here. Love. And I'm not claiming to understand it, but I know it when I get it. I know it when I give it. So anyway, Jim and Eddie are having a theological debate. Now, I'm the guy that used to jump right in the middle of that. But the fight was gone. I'm sitting there. I had done some things to hurt my brother 2 weeks before. I had no right to be in his house. But he said, you come in. So I think they probably had some beer in the refrigerator. But I was so broken and so embarrassed and ashamed of what I had done to him, I didn't dare ask anybody for that. Because the last time I'd been there drunk, I'd really done some not very nice things. And these guys are going back and forth. Jim's drinking. Eddie's not. And it was out of the mouth of the drunk, the words came that were like the final lance that just cut right through for a moment. And I love what Earl was saying last night. It doesn't last, but there is a moment where all of a sudden it's like something opens up and you can see the truth. All the ego, all the stories, all of the, you know, what goes on in this head most of the time is there's this defense attorney that's always walking around and, well, Your Honor, it's like this. And I'm buying it. I'm saying, he's right, you know. And that's been my life. You know, something happens. I get cut off in traffic. 3 seconds later, the defense attorney is already, you know, I'm a good guy. I'm a victim of circumstances. He's an asshole. That's just the way it is. I'm not a participant in this. That's what is the story of my life. That's what my ego will constantly do. It will put story upon story upon story so that by the time you get about 37 layers out, it's like, I have no clue. These were the words. Jim Dunning said, you know, Eddie, I don't know a single man who doesn't have a master. You show me a man who says he's self-made, and I'll show you a man who's a slave to pride. And I don't know how else to say it, except that cut through me. I saw the truth. Not even the alcoholism. I knew I was an alcoholic. It was deeper. Pride. Slave to pride. All of a sudden, I saw in a flash, from the moment I would come to in the morning, pride would kick in and say, well, you know, he's an asshole. You know, the reason that you had that fight last night was because he's such a blah, blah, blah. And I could see it for what it was. It was pride. It was pride defending. It was pride saying, get up. Now, you put a face on it and go out. Any of y'all ever do this? Come to from a blackout? And you know, you gotta make amends, but you don't know to who yet or what. So you have to kind of feel your way into relationships. Hey, how are we doing? You know? That was a way of life for me. So pride was always there. Always telling me what to do next. Put a face on it. Act like everything is good. And when I saw it, I don't know how else to say it except that this was a moment of grace for me. I was able to see the power that pride had in my life to the extent that it was like It's not like I have a problem with pride or I have this thing going on with pride. No, pride has me. I saw it. I saw it for what it was. And when I saw it, it shocked, appalled, and scared me. Now, I'm having a conversation with myself about this. I've moved on from the theological debate. And when I'm having this reaction, first thing that comes to my mind is, well, I ain't putting up with that shit. I'm in grace. And I was able to see that was the most prideful thing, the most arrogant thing I could have said. It had me. I wasn't in charge. I'd been invited to Alcoholics Anonymous. My brother Doug, who's at home with his wife right now, who's not doing well, not doing well at all. Doug had invited me to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I had been exposed, but pride kept me out. So I don't need that shit. I'm not that bad. I saw it for what it was. About this time, Archie comes into the room. He sits down next to me. He says, "So, how you doing?" And I just looked at him, and this is what came out of my mouth. And I'll tell you the reason it came out of my mouth in that moment. I looked at him and I said, "I want to go to AA. Will you take me?" And he tells his own story, but he looked at me shocked. And he's told me since. He said, "I never thought I'd hear those words come out of you." But he said, "Yeah, I'll take you." Now, the reason I said it in that moment is I didn't trust myself. If I slept on it and said, "Okay, I'm going to go to AA." If I slept on it, my first reaction, I know, when I came to, would have been, let's not overreact here. You know, let's just sit on it. And I didn't trust myself. Thank God I did not trust myself. I was ready and did not even know that I was ready. Archie took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I talk about this a lot. I talked about this at our little workshop on Friday. That group was into the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. They did, like I am so honored to be a part of when I see other groups do this. They made it a first step meeting for me, and they did it the right way. Nobody preached at me. Nobody told me what the big book meant or any of that. They went around the room and each person shared themselves. What I was talking about earlier about connection, we're built this way. No man is an island, all that good stuff. I'm not built to be alone. Something began to happen to me at that meeting. First guy that shared, he started talking and he was telling his truth, his experience. And I was connecting with it. I was like, wow, this is amazing. I'm so glad he went first. I could really connect with him. Then the next guy, and then the next person. I was open. I was teachable. I was ready and didn't even know it. For those of you all from Athens, two people were in there that are still around. Stephen C. was in that room. He shared. And there was a little old lady that was, at that time, probably 10 years younger than I am now, that was sitting there. I said, "I wonder if I'm going to relate to Vivian M." And she shared, had me rolling. I couldn't believe it. And I knew. I knew in that moment, in that instant, that I was home. I knew it. Even though another part of my brain was going, "Are these people trying to brainwash me? Is this some kind of a cult? Or they want to take over my, you know," all that crazy stuff. Stephen C. came up to me after that first meeting and did something I'll be forever grateful for. What Earl was talking about, the newcomer. He got me back the next day. I mean, the other higher power other than pride that I had going on with me was fear. Every waking moment I was scared to damn death. Of what hell? I don't know. Or I didn't know. I have more of a clue now. But he came up to me and he said, "You're probably afraid that you're going to have to come to these meetings and sit around in these chairs and drink coffee out of styrofoam cups for the rest of your life, right?" oh, I don't know, I guess. And he said, well, guess what? You don't have to. I said, this guy's obviously picked up on the fact that I'm a college graduate. I don't know about any of the rest of you all, but, you know, we get pretty impressed with each other in our length of sobriety. As a newcomer, you know, I'd hear somebody with 30 days and I'd say, wow, wow. Somebody with 10 years, my reaction was, what the hell are you still doing here? I mean, come on, get it, you know? I didn't understand. I really didn't. He said, you don't have to come back for the rest of your life. He said, if you got something out of today, just come back tomorrow. This was a Wednesday. And so I asked the question. I said, okay, I can do tomorrow, but what about Friday? Because Friday's when you drink, right? Well, for me, Tuesday was when you drank. It didn't matter, but that was in my mind. That was the idea. And he said, you just come back tomorrow. Don't worry about Friday. And he got me back. One day at a time. I had no idea I would still be here 38 years later. Be behind the podium. I want to talk about the newcomer and the podium thing. Because I started to say this in the beginning. I can't see what the hell this says. Here, tell me when I have to shut up, okay? Thank you for the watch. My first Friday that I came to the Biscayne, it was a speaker's meeting night. And you remember those days, Ben? Yeah. And there would be, it would be a full house. There would be about 20 people there, you know. And then somebody would get behind the podium and speak. And I'm looking at them and it's like, where did they get this person? Did they, you know, did they pay him from some professional? And then I find out, no, they're just an alcoholic. They're in such and such a group. And my first thought was, well, you'll never catch me doing something like that. Ain't no way, man. I got to have about 3 drinks under my belt if I'm going to get up in front and talk to somebody. Hey, that's not going to happen. 6 months sober. Thursday night, I went to the Biscayne Room. And I met a guy that was hurting. He was in a lot of pain. I spent about 20, 30 minutes with him after the meeting and felt that connection because his eyes lit up and he connected with me. And I could see the thing happening that I believe is one of the most important spiritual things that we pass on to each other. He was getting a little hope. Maybe there's a way for me. Maybe there's a way. Friday night, I go to the speaker's meeting. I get there at 8:25. The meeting started at 8:30. And I go up to the coffee pot, and I'm pouring myself a cup of coffee. And here comes Lee. Lee's, at that point, had 10 years of sobriety. And he comes up to me. And Lee was not usually that warm and fuzzy with me. But he comes up to me and says, hey, Jim, how you doing? And I said, oh, I'm good. How you doing? And he said, good. He said, guess who's speaking tonight? And like a dumbass, I said, who? And he said, you, and turned around and walked away. And I don't know if anybody else has had this experience, but I mean, it wasn't like, okay, just run out of the room, leave. Said, that's what I wanted to do, but I didn't see that as an option. I sat down and I started projecting. I'm going to get up here. I'm going to start fiddling with stuff. I'm going to start freaking out. Everybody's going to see I'm freaking out, which is going to make me more self-conscious, and then I'm going to freak out even more, and then I'm just pass out. You know, I saw it. I mean, and I said, take a deep breath. And every time I take it, don't think about that. Well, it's like, don't think about green monkeys with wings, you know. It's like, shit, that's all I can get. You know, it was getting, I was going psychotic, just sitting there, waiting to speak. How do you do it? How do you do this? The miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous happened for me this way. I got up behind that podium, and my worst fears were starting to come true. It was starting to happen, and all of a sudden, I looked in the back of the room, and he was in the back of the room because he didn't feel worthy to be up front. Was the guy I met the night before. And he had that same look. He said, oh, this is the man I connected with last night. This is the man that gave me a little hope. And I could see that hopefulness in his eyes. and I talked to him. Everybody else went away. I said, to hell with it. I'm going to share with him. So what Earl said last night, I really loved it. I really loved it about the newcomer. It's not just that the newcomer is most important because that's something nice to say and everybody, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's because it did say, gave me what I needed on that particular night. I knew how to speak from behind the podium ever since in Alcoholics Anonymous. I would look for someone. I would get up here for the purpose, not of being impressive or trying to, let me give this message, but to try to offer some hope to someone that maybe is not feeling a whole lot of hope out there. It has happened for me over and over since I've been in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love what I heard a speaker share one time. I think it was Sandy B. He said, sobriety is not a momentous event. It's an epic journey. Well, I've been doing this 38 years, and I'm telling you, it is. It's an epic journey. There's been things that have happened for me over and over and over that have kept me connected. I was talking with Bobby M. last night about school. Well, I went back to school. 6-7 months sober, I went back into college, and you know, there were some defects of character that I had when I was drunk that followed me into, okay, I've got to study for a test next week. I'll do it later. I'll do some other things. By the end of, at that time it was a quarter system, by the end of the quarter I was like freaking out. It's like everything was piling up. I can't get it all done, all of this. Little things would happen. Like I'd go to the Biscayne room and I just need to have a cup of coffee just to, you know, and I'm thinking, literally thinking about dropping out of school. And there's Norman standing there. Now you have to know, Norman was a guy who had family, kids. He was not terribly bright, but he was smart enough to use a GI Bill to help buy groceries for his kids. He'd go to school and get some money, and that helped supplement. He worked at the chicken factory there. He would come into meetings, oh my gosh, wearing those high rubber boots and, you know. But Norman, I walk into the room with this heavy on my mind, and Norman is standing there. He's got a sheet of paper there, and he's got his overalls and his galoshes on, and he's going, "Hot damn! I made a D!" True story! He said, "I'm in another quarter, man. I can do this. I can..." Nobody could have given me anything else that would have, you know, I got all the encouragement. I'm like, you know, you're doing okay, just keep going. No, Norman with his stuff is like, quit taking yourself so seriously, just keep going. Life is messy, it's not perfect, just keep going. I get these nudges, I've had these things that have happened repeatedly. I've had experiences that I don't really have time to get into all of them, but I want to talk for just a minute about this business of connection and spirituality. Because I still have these moments. I have these times when I don't feel that connected. I feel like I have failed. I'm not measuring up. Or other people aren't doing what they need to do. And the bottom line for me is this, and this is the thing that I learned in that moment of grace the very first day I came in here, that I am up against something. The principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, the first step of recovery, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Well, guess what? The whole world is not powerless over alcohol, but damn it, they ain't got it together about everything else. Are there a lot of people out there that think they do? Have it all figured out? The control. Life is too big. It's just too big. And it avails me of two things because it is too big. And I want to quote something from Bill Wilson. This was from a great Valiant article. I think it was written in the 1960s. By then, Alcoholics Anonymous was flourishing. I mean, there were hundreds of thousands of people in recovery at that point in time. And they were having some inner discussions within the rooms. It's like, why does it work? I mean, what has happened? This phenomena, this this thing where people are getting, what is it? And a lot of people were saying, well, it's because, you know, one alcoholic talking to another, all the stuff that we talk about to preserve who and what we are. Bill Wilson, you know what he said? The reason AA works, the reason we have what we have right now, is a mystery. And because it's a mystery, we have no other word for it but miracle. I have got to experience, and I'm going to pull something from my college education. I didn't remember much, but I did pick up a couple of little jewels. The word religion. You know where the word religion comes from? Anybody? It's a Latin root. 2,000 years ago, the word was religio. And it was not a noun. It was a verb. Several interpretations of what that verb meant. The one I liked, and I still like. It's a verb that we don't have the equivalent of in our language today. The act of standing in awe of. Religio. Varieties of religious experience. Alcoholics Anonymous. What I experience in sobriety and what I have experienced, and I hope and pray I continue to experience, is that experience of awe. I had a moment of it. It mimicked it. It lied with the booze. It was like, oh, ah. And I kept looking for it. There's so much truth in that thing that I was trying to fill that hole, that spiritual hole, with booze. Recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous teaches me, embrace the mystery. Now, if it's a mystery, guess what that means? Riley, you're not in control of it. Stop trying to control it so much. Encounter it. Embrace it. Connect. Now, again, one of the ways I connect is I get out in traffic. Six assholes pull in front of me. I'm not in control. What am I in control of? And I actually got this from Archie talking to him on the phone this morning. It's like, duh, you need connection. You're connecting with reality in a way that's really frustrating you right now. Connect with some people in recovery. As I was talking about Nelson and I talked on the phone. It was a connection that interrupted that negative connection. That has happened to me over and over again in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I cannot tell you how many times I have felt hopeless, despair, suicidal, stark raving sober. It ain't working anymore. And then somebody like Norman comes along, hot damn! The miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, the humility that you people have given me with your lives, who you are. I have no other word for it except love. And I believe with all my heart, from my own experience, that love does conquer all. It conquered my alcoholism and will continue to do so. And I know that if I ever get to that point where I start to disconnect again, pull away, I'm going to start thinking, well, maybe I need a drink. And for this boy to take a drink, and I've been around long enough, I've sponsored people that I've loved, and I've watched them pick a drink, and it's like, it's freaky. When I was new and people were saying, for me to drink is to die, I said, oh, aren't we overreacting a little bit? You might get sick, go to jail, but come on. For me to drink is to die. I've seen it. If you haven't been around long enough to see what happens to people that don't stay around long enough to see it. Because it'll blow your mind. People that I've known and loved that have worked this program, that have sponsored people, they pick up a drink and say, well, it's different. I think it's going to be as like the lights are on, but the shades have been pulled down. I said, hello, where are you? They're gone. This thing is powerful. It's a spiritual disease. It's a spiritual malady. What Kent was saying on Friday night. There's only one solution for a spiritual malady, and that's a spiritual solution. 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous have been my path. Richard, I don't know if you're in the room, but I do want to honor. I think about Frankie because Frankie was one of the people that I met at the State Assembly in 1980, January of 1980. I came to my first State Assembly, and Frankie was one of the people up there at the podium and just blew my mind. Frankie was a pretty impressive guy. Over the years, I watched Frankie deteriorate from MS, another disease. Frankie not only stayed sober through that experience, he became huge. He carried a message of sobriety that's hard to put into words. The more physically debilitated he became, the more humble and more grateful he became. We would go up to the nursing home in Jonesboro and we would laughingly, Billy would reach down, pick Frankie up, put him in his special wheelchair. We'd roll him outside. We'd feed him chocolate because he couldn't even move himself anymore. And we would say, "What do you want to talk about tonight, Frankie?" Frankie always wanted to talk about gratitude, and we knew that. It was sort of a joke. People like that have carried the message of what this thing is, what it looks like, what it tastes like, what it feels like, and how wonderful it is. But do I understand it? I don't get it. How does somebody whose life is deteriorating like that become more and more grateful, more and more able to give? People that only knew Frankie when he was in that condition. I knew Frankie the whole journey. Some of you all in here did too. Frankie is one of those people that carried the message. Matt, my sponsor Matt. A lot of people in the room know Matt. I would be remiss if I didn't say something about him. Matt was a man I didn't just do a fifth step with once, twice, 10 times. Matt was a man that walked the epic journey with me for 25 years. He knew me. He was a guy that early in my recovery, I'd get back around my family, I'd get cross-eyed and crazy. It's like my dad would just push my buttons in. Well, Matt got to a point, he'd look at me and say, "Hey, Jim, hey, you been back down to see your old man?" He knew me that well. And I cannot tell you how special that kind of a relationship is, that connection. To be able just to get in the car with somebody that you've been on the journey with. Nelson and I have had this, Billy and I, Ben. We've had these kinds of connections that are priceless. These are the things I looked for when I was on my 17th drink at the bar. Said, "Hey, you're my best friend in the world." Then 3 more drinks, you're fist fighting. "Hey, you stole my money." You know, I looked for it there. You get to find it here. The real thing. What you also get to find, and I'll never forget, I was working for Georgia Department of Corrections at that time. I pulled up at Dooley State Prison, pulled into the parking lot, and it was Matt's wife. She never called me. He had a heart attack last night. Broke my heart. Broke my heart. He had a heart attack on June the 10th, AA's birthday, 2007. They pulled the plug on that Thursday. It devastated me. It broke my heart. But it did not stop my sobriety. Matt was one of those guys that ain't about me. He never was that way. It was about connection, but not about ego connection. It's not about, "Oh, listen to what I've got to say because I'm so great." He loved drunks. People loved him because they knew he loved them. You stay here. Avail yourself of the opportunity of this thing called sobriety. Some amazing things are going to happen. Is it all going to tickle? No. But I'll guarantee you will wake up one day and you will say, "Yes, I lived. I lived. I did the deal. I wasn't in the gutter on the sideline drunk watching the parade go by. I was in it." I'll be forever grateful for this program and what you people have given me. I heard a speaker quote, and this is not AA literature, excuse me, but I heard this from the podium at Callaway Gardens back around 1983, back when they used to do the Pine Mountain thing, and I loved it because It was the one poet that I fell in love with when I was in high school. William Wordsworth. And it just resonates with me because to me, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is about coming home. When I got fired in 1996, I told everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous, hey, I lost my job. Rift. I was downsized. They just closed the door. Nothing personal. Gotta go. Well, I get a call from Abe, from Warner Robins, and Abe, he says, Riley, I understand you don't have a job. And I said, yeah, that's right. And he said, well, then you ain't got no damn excuse. I'm going to be by Monday morning to pick you up. We're going to Founders Day. You ain't got to pay for anything. I got you back. What do you say to that? We got in the car. And I was going through some resentments about something that I made the mistake of sharing with him. An air conditioning guy that was ripping me off. I don't have the money to do this, blah, 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 and all of this. And between Macon and Atlanta, and he's, Abe was one of these guys, he loved Cracker Barrel, he loved Alcoholics Anonymous, and he loved Catholic churches. So we hit every one between here and Akron, Ohio. But we stop at the Triangle Club, and we go into a meeting, and does anybody have anything that they need to bring up? And Abe says, yeah, he does. He needs to talk about an air conditioning man. Go ahead. By the time we got to Lexington, Kentucky, I said, shut up, you know. I was through with it. But the connection that I have made, the thing that happened when we got up there and we met Doug G. Picked him up at the airport. We went to a place called the Dry People's Club in Akron, Ohio. We walked in. It was an old biker bar that had been converted into an AA clubhouse. We go into places full of people and they're milling around. We go up to the bar and you have to know Abe and Doug. You can't miss them. So we had a small gathering of people around us within about 2 minutes. Strange place, never been there before. We talk, where are you from? Tell them where we're from. And somebody said what they say up there. Welcome home. And we felt it. I felt it. I went to the bars looking for that, to find it in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's what I always look for. You people have given it to me. Our birth is but a sleep and a forgetting. The soul that rises with us, our life star, hath had elsewhere its setting and cometh from afar. Not in entire nakedness nor in utter forgetfulness, but trailing clouds of glory do we come from God, who is our home. If you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous or if you're not, welcome home. Thank you all very much.